Imagine quitting your job at 40 years old, cashing out your entire government retirement account, and legally bypassing the 10% early withdrawal penalty that the IRS slaps on basically everyone else.
Yeah, which sounds like some kind of offshore tax fraud, right?
It totally does. It sounds completely illegal, but it is actually completely legal if you happen to be holding the right kind of account.
Exactly.
So today we are mapping the entire life cycle of a client as wealth, and we're specifically calibrating this for the Series 6 exam.
Right.
We're taking a single dollar from the moment an account is opened. We're going to drag it through the gauntlet of employer retirement plans, figure out how to move it around without, the IRS holding it hostage.
Yeah, they love to do that.
They really do. And finally, we're looking at the tax bombshells that go off when someone inherits it.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
It is. But before we get into the weeds, a quick shout out to Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 6 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real test. You can check them out at certfuel.com.
Awesome.
All right, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Before we even talk about opening a brokerage account, we need to establish what a Series 6 license actually lets you do. Because, I mean, my understanding is that it's a fairly restricted ticket. Like, you can't just do whatever you want.
Oh, absolutely. It is a very, very specific ticket. The Series 6 license basically permits you to sell packaged investment products.
Okay. So what does that actually mean?
So we are talking about mutual funds, variable annuities, 529 college savings plans, and unit investment trusts, or UITs, which are essentially these static, unmanaged portfolios of bonds or stocks that you hold until maturity.
Right.
But the crucial mechanism here, the thing you really need to understand, is how you get paid. With the Series 6, you are executing transactions for a commission.
Okay, so if I pass this exam, I can look at a client's profile, determine that a specific, I don't know, growth mutual fund is suitable for them, execute the trade, and then earn a commission on that sale.
Precisely. You are being compensated for a point-in-time transaction.
Yes.
It's based on suitability at that exact moment.
But what if I want to just like charge them a flat 1% fee every year to manage that mutual fund portfolio? Because honestly, that seems like a much better business model for me.
I mean, it might be. A lot of people prefer it, but you cannot do it with just a Series 6.
Really?
Yeah. Charging an ongoing asset-based fee for continuous portfolio management requires a second ticket, specifically the Series 65 or 66, which registers you as an investment advisor representative or an IIR.
Okay.
The regulatory logic here is that an ongoing fee implies ongoing advice and fiduciary monitoring, which is just a completely different regulatory framework than executing a one-time commission trade.
That makes sense. So let me throw a scenario at you. If I'm staring at a multiple choice question on the exam and it says a Series 6 representative wants to open a wrap fee program for a client where the advice, execution, and custody are all bundled into one annual fee, but the catch is that the account will only hold basic mutual funds.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Right. I can do that, right?
Yeah.
Because my license covers mutual funds. That's the loophole.
Nope. That is one of the absolute most common traps on the exam. Do not fall for it.
Wait, really? Even if it's only mutual funds?
Even if it's only mutual funds, the regulators do not care what the underlying assets are. The moment you introduce an ongoing wrap fee, you are crossing the line into investment advisory services.
Wow.
Yeah. Without that IRR registration, you are legally stuck at the station. You just can't do it.
Okay, I am logging that away. Good to know. So, staying firmly in our commission-based package product lane, let's look at the actual mechanics of getting a client on the books.
Let's do it.
Let's look at a case study. We'll call him Reckless Randy. He is the archetype of a high-frequency, high-emotion retail trader. He bursts into your branch office, highly caffeinated, and demands to open an account immediately.
We all know a reckless Randy.
We really do. What are the absolute bare minimum pieces of information the firm needs to collect just to get his account open?
Well, the regulators govern this through what's called the customer account information rule, and they break it down into two distinct tiers.
Yay, two tiers.
Right. Tier one is the non-negotiable data. If you don't have this, Randy doesn't get an account, period.
So what's on that list?
You need his full legal name. You need his physical residential address. And a PO box is not acceptable for this because of anti-money laundering or AML laws.
Right, they need to know where you live.
Exactly. The government needs to know where this person actually sleeps. Then you need to verify he is of legal age to enter into a binding contract. And finally, you need a signature on the new account form.
Okay, let me guess. It needs to be the signature of the registered representative who is taking the account, right? Like, to prove I met him and vetted him.
Surprisingly, no.
Wait, it's not?
No, the rep's signature isn't the critical one for acceptance. The required signature must be from a partner, an officer, or a manager of the firm.
Wait, really? Not a registered principal? Because whenever I read about Series 6 compliance, registered principal is like the answer to everything regarding approvals.
And that is exactly why it's a massive trick question on the exam. You have to separate the firm's duties.
Okay, break that down for me.
So a registered principal is someone who has passed a higher level exam like the Series 26, and their job is to conduct product-specific supervisory reviews.
Got it.
They approve your specific mutual fund trades to ensure they are suitable. But the actual act of opening an account, of establishing a legal business relationship with a new human being,
yeah,
that is an executive function. That falls to a partner, officer, or manager, denoting that the account complies with the firm's broader policies.
Okay, that actually makes a lot of sense when you separate the trade itself from the relationship with the firm. So that just adds tier one. What is tier two?
Tier two covers information that the firm must make reasonable efforts to obtain before the initial transaction settles.
Reasonable efforts.
Right. This includes Randy's tax identification number, or social security number, his occupation, and the name and address of his employer.
Wait, why does the brokerage care where Randy works?
Because they need to know if he is an associated person of another member firm.
Oh, like if he's a spy.
Basically. If Randy works for a rival broker-dealer, there are strict FINRA rules about opening outside accounts to prevent insider trading or, you know, hiding risky trades from his employer.
Okay, but you said reasonable efforts. What if Randy is just incredibly paranoid and flat out refuses to give me his employer's address? Am I paralyzed? Can I not open the account?
No, you're fine. If you ask for the tier two information and the client refuses to provide it, you just document the refusal in their file. The rule demands reasonable effort, not absolute success.
Okay, so I just write down Randy is paranoid, wouldn't tell me.
Exactly. With the refusal documented, you can proceed with opening the account based on the tier one data.
Okay, I have a direct question for everyone listening. Pause and think about this one. Let's say reckless Randy comes in and he doesn't want my advice. He doesn't want a recommendation. He just slaps a check on the desk and says, put this entirely into the Vanguard S&P 500 open-end mutual fund. It's an unsolicited, non-recommended trade, and his account will only ever hold mutual funds. Does the firm still need to hustle for his tax ID under tier two? Give it a second.
It's a tricky one.
It is. Okay, what's the answer?
The answer is no. In that highly specific scenario, there's a carve-out in the rules. If the account is strictly for mutual funds and the firm is not making any recommendations, meaning it's entirely unsolicited, you are completely exempt from the tier two reasonable efforts requirements.
That feels like a massive loophole. Why would regulators allow that?
It comes down to systemic risk. Mutual funds are highly diversified, heavily regulated, packaged products. The regulators essentially concluded that if a client is just buying a basic mutual fund on their own volition, without a broker pushing them into it, the risk of catastrophic financial ruin or market manipulation is low enough that the firm doesn't need to conduct the exhaustive tier two background check.
Fascinating. Okay, let's contrast Randy with another archetype. We'll call her Cautious Clara.
Love Clara.
Right. She reads every word of the fine print, she wants total security, and she is generally very risk averse. When we open Clara's account, I know there is a relatively new FINRA rule requiring us to ask her for a trusted contact person, or a TCP.
Oh yes, the trusted contact person rule was implemented specifically to combat the rising tide of financial exploitation targeting seniors and vulnerable adults.
It's a huge problem.
It really is. So the firm must ask Clara to provide the name and contact info of someone who is at least 18 years old.
So if I'm Clara and I name my daughter as my TCP, I'm basically giving my daughter the power of attorney to trade my mutual funds if I get sick.
Absolutely not. And you have to burn this distinction into your memory for the exam.
Okay.
A TCP has zero trading authority. They cannot execute trades. They cannot authorize wire transfers. They cannot change the address on the account. They are not a power of attorney.
Then what on earth is the point of having them on file?
They are purely an emergency contact. Imagine you are the broker and Clara suddenly calls you requesting a massive, highly uncharacteristic wire transfer to an offshore crypto exchange.
Which Clara would never do.
Exactly. She sounds confused on the phone and someone is whispering in the background. Or perhaps you just haven't been able to reach her for 6 months and mail is bouncing back.
That's terrifying.
Right. So you can call the TCP. You are permitted to disclose limited information to them to confirm Clara's health status or to flag suspected financial exploitation. That's it.
It's a safety net, not a steering wheel.
That's a great way to put it.
Got it. Now, between Randy and Clara, we are generating a massive amount of paperwork. And the Series 6 loves to test record retention.
Oh, they obsess over it.
Let's talk about the timeline. How often do I have to send this account file back to Clara to verify her address and investment objectives haven't changed?
You must send the account record to the customer within 30 days of opening the account, and then you must send it again at least once every 36 months thereafter.
36 months. So every 3 years. That's the trap right there, because my brain immediately wants to assume it's an annual compliance requirement.
Yep. The exam will absolutely put every 12 months as a decoy answer.
Okay, what about retention? If Clara eventually closes her account and moves to a different firm, how long does my brokerage have to hoard her old paperwork in our archives?
You must retain customer account records for 6 years after the account is closed.
Wait, after it closes?
After it closes.
So if Clara keeps her account with me for 40 years, the six-year retention clock doesn't even start ticking until year 41.
Exactly.
Why do they need us to keep it for that long after she's gone?
Because systemic fraud and money laundering often take years to unravel.
I see.
If regulators are investigating a massive financial crime a decade from now, they need to be able to follow the paper trail backward. If firms threw away records the moment an account closed, the entire audit trail would just vanish.
That makes total sense. Okay, so we've talked about the paperwork to open an account, but the actual ownership titling of the account is arguably much more important because it dictates what happens when things go terribly legally wrong.
It does. And this raises an important question. The exam heavily tests joint accounts, specifically how they handle the death of an owner.
Okay, let's bring back Reckless Randy. Let's say Randy and his best buddy open a joint brokerage account together. They both fund it, they buy some growth funds, but then an incredibly absurd tragedy strikes. Randy goes surfing and he gets eaten by a shark. Totally gone.
Tragic.
Tragic. What happens to the money in that joint account? Does Randy's share go to his family?
It depends entirely on three little letters on the new account form. Did they open it as JTWROS or as TIC?
Okay, let's break down JTWROS first.
It stands for Joint Tenants with Right of Survivorship. Under this structure, both owners own 100% of the undivided account.
So there is no Randy put in 60%, so he owns 60%. It's just a single bucket that they both possess entirely.
Correct. So the moment the shark eats Randy, his buddy instantly, legally owns the entire account. The primary benefit of JTWROS, and the key phrase you really need to look for on the exam, is that the assets pass outside of probate.
Okay, we should probably define probate, because if you've never dealt with an estate, you might not realize what an absolute nightmare it is.
It is awful.
Probate is the legal, court-supervised process of validating a dead person's will, paying off their creditors, and distributing whatever is left to their heirs. It is public, it requires really expensive lawyers, and it can freeze assets for months or even years.
Exactly. It's a sluggish, terrible bureaucracy. JTWROS completely bypasses that. The surviving buddy essentially just presents a death certificate to the brokerage firm, and the money is his to trade or withdraw. The court never touches it.
But what if they had chosen TUS, or tenants in common? How does the shark attack play out there?
Under tenants in common, ownership is explicitly fractured. Each owner holds a specified fractional share. Let's say the paperwork stated Randy owned 70% and his buddy owned 30%.
Okay.
When Randy dies, his 70% share does not automatically go to his buddy.
Where does it go?
It goes directly into Randy's estate. It becomes subject to his will, and it absolutely must grind through the probate courts. The buddy retains his 30%, but that 70% is frozen until the judge and the lawyers figure out who Randy's legal heirs are.
Wow. So if I'm taking the Series 6, I shouldn't be worrying about the day-to-day trading mechanics of these accounts, like whether Randy needed his buddy's permission to buy a mutual fund. I need to be focused on the morbid stuff.
Yes. The exam tests the death consequences. If you see right of survivorship, link it immediately to avoiding the will and bypassing probate.
Got it.
If you see tenants in common, link it to fractional shares flowing into the deceased's estate.
Okay. Let's shift from individuals to businesses. Let's introduce a new archetype, Forgetful Frank.
I like Frank already.
He is a brilliant but highly disorganized tech founder. He wants to open a corporate brokerage account for his startup. Can he just walk into my office, drop his CEO business card on the desk, and start buying corporate bond funds?
Not a chance. When dealing with entity accounts, whether it's a C corporation, a partnership, or an unincorporated association, the firm must follow what I call the two-document rule.
Two-document rule.
You need two entirely separate layers of legal proof before any trades can happen.
Well, I assume the first document just proves the business is real, right?
Exactly. You need proof of existence. If it's a corporation, we need the corporate charter or the articles of incorporation filed with the state.
Sure.
If it's a partnership, we need the formal partnership agreement. This proves to the broker-dealer that they are contracting with a legitimate legal entity, not a shell company Frank dreamed up over the weekend.
But a piece of paper can't place a trade. Like a human being has to pick up the phone or click the mouse. So what's the second document?
The second document is the corporate resolution. This is a formal document signed by the board of directors that explicitly names the living, breathing human beings who are legally authorized to execute trades and move money on behalf of the corporation.
Okay, but wait. Frank is the founder. He's the CEO. He probably owns 80% of the stock. Let's say his assistant fills out the corporate resolution and forgets to put Frank's name on the authorized trader list. Can I still take a trade from him? I mean, he literally owns the place.
Absolutely not. Corporate liability is strictly defined. If Frank's name is not on that resolution, he cannot execute a single trade.
Even as the CEO?
Even as the CEO. If you, as the Series 6 rep, take an order from him anyway, and the trade loses money, the corporation could legally sue your brokerage firm, arguing that an unauthorized individual depleted their assets. You must have both, the charter for existence and the resolution for trading authority.
I actually love how strict that is. It removes all the guesswork.
It really does.
Okay, I want to pivot slightly because we are entering a danger zone.
Oh.
There are two specific rules regarding customer accounts that sound similar, operate in similar administrative territory, and routinely cause test takers to fail. I want to frame this like a heavyweight boxing match to keep them separated in our minds.
I love a good boxing match. Let's set the stage.
All right. In the red corner, we have the customer account records rule.
Okay.
This dictates the protocol for when a customer wants to change the name or designation on their account. For example, Clara gets married and wants to change her account from an individual account to a joint account with her new husband.
Right. So the customer account records rule is highly bureaucratic. A registered representative cannot simply cross out the old name and write in the new one.
That would be too easy.
Way too easy. The rule requires that a registered principal be personally informed of the essential facts surrounding the change. Furthermore, that principal must approve the change in writing.
So, red corner. Name changes require a principal and it must be in writing. In the blue corner, we have the negotiable instrument authorization rule.
Fancy name.
Very fancy. This comes into play when a client wants to automate their investments. Let's say Claire wants to buy $500 of mutual fund every month, and instead of mailing us a check, she says, can you just automatically draw the funds from my outside Chase checking account?
Okay, for the blue corner rule, the firm must have the customer's express written authorization to pull those funds.
Right.
The firm cannot initiate a draw on an outside bank without a signed document from Clara. But the real knockout punch for the exam is the record-keeping requirement for this specific piece of paper.
Okay, audience, direct question time. Let me guess how this works.
Yeah.
Let's say Clara signs an authorization that says you can pull $500 a month for exactly 3 years. That authorization will eventually expire, right? Well, when does the 3-year record-keeping clock start? Think about it.
The classic trap.
So, what's the answer?
The firm must keep that written authorization for 3 years after the authorization expires.
After it expires. So if she signs a 3-year authorization in 2024, it expires in 2027. We have to keep the piece of paper in our files until 2030.
Exactly. And that is why test takers confuse them. The exam will mix and match the requirements.
Sneaky.
Very. They will ask if a customer's written authorization is needed to change an account name. No, that requires a principal. Or they will ask if a principal needs to approve a bank draw. No. That requires customer authorization. Keep the red corner and the blue corner strictly separated.
That is incredibly helpful. All right, we've got the accounts open. We know who owns them and we know how to change the names. Now let's talk about where the massive volume of middle-class wealth is actually generated. The workplace.
Yes, the daily grind.
We need to talk about employer-sponsored retirement plans. And you literally cannot talk about that without talking about ERESA.
No, you can't. The Employer Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. To understand why ERISA exists, you have to look at the history of pensions. Before 1974, the private pension landscape was essentially the Wild West.
Really? How bad was it?
Bad enough to require federal intervention. The catalyst was often things like the Studebaker Automobile Company collapse in the 1960s.
Oh, I read about that.
Yeah, thousands of workers had been promised pensions, but when the company went under, the pension fund was just empty.
Wow.
Workers who had given 30 years of their lives to a factory were left with absolutely nothing. ERISA was drafted to stop that.
So what did it do?
It established strict minimum standards for private sector retirement plans. It mandated that if a private company promises you retirement benefits, they must fund those benefits in a separate protected trust, and they cannot discriminate in favor of highly compensated executives.
Okay, so it's the private sector rule book. And the first major rule of ERISA is eligibility. Like, an employer can't just keep you out of the 401k plan forever to save money. The magic numbers for mandatory inclusion are age 21 and 1 year of service. But how does the IRS define a year of service?
It is defined as 1,000 hours worked in a 12-month period. If you meet both of those criteria, 21 years old and 1,000 hours, the employer legally must allow you to participate in the plan.
But getting access to the plan is only half the battle, right?
Oh, yeah.
The other half is vesting. Vesting is basically just a fancy corporate word for ownership. When does the money in that 401k actually belong to me so that if I rage quit on a Tuesday, I can take the cash with me?
This is a highly testable concept. Let's use forgetful Frank again.
Okay.
Frank is participating in his company's 401k. He defers $5,000 of his own salary into the plan. His employer offers a match, and they put in $2,000.
Okay, audience, here's your question. There is $7,000 total in the account. If Frank quits tomorrow, what happens to the $5,000 of his own money that came out of his paycheck? Think on it.
Give him a second.
All right, what's the verdict?
The $5,000 of Frank's own deferred salary is always 100% immediately vested. You never have to wait to own your own money. The moment it hits the account, it belongs to you.
I mean, that's a relief. But what about the $2,000 employer match?
That is where vesting schedules apply. Employers use the match as a retention tool, golden handcuffs, basically.
Right.
ERISA allows them to use schedules like a three-year cliff, where Frank owns 0% of the match until his three-year work anniversary, at which point he instantly owns 100%.
Like jumping off a cliff.
Exactly. Or they can use a graded schedule, where he earns a certain percentage of the match each year between year two and year six.
So if I see a question about vesting schedules, I need to immediately isolate whether they are asking about the employee's contribution or the employer's match.
Exactly. Employee money is always yours. Employer money operates on a timeline.
Okay. Now, ERISA covers private corporate companies, but what about public sector workers? Teachers, firefighters, sanitation workers, they use a completely different alphabet soup of tax codes. Let's compare the 403B and the 457B.
They do sound similar, but they serve different public sectors. A 403B, which is often called a tax-sheltered annuity, is primarily used by public educational institutions, universities, and 501c3 nonprofit organizations.
So a high school biology teacher uses a 403.
Yes. A 457, on the other hand, is the deferred compensation plan for state and local government employees. Think police officers, city planners, municipal transit workers.
And this brings us back to the hook we started the show with. Here's where it gets really interesting. The 457B has a loophole, a superpower that the Series 6 exam loves to test. And it all stems from the fact that governmental 457B plans are not covered by ERISA.
That's right. Because they are government plans, they are exempt from the private sector ERISA framework. And that creates a massive divergence in how early withdrawals are penalized.
Right. With almost every other qualified retirement plan, a 401k, a 403B, a traditional IRA, if you pull money out before you reach age 59 and a half, the IRS hits you with a 10% early withdrawal penalty on top of whatever normal income taxes you owe. It is designed to punish you for raiding your retirement.
But the governmental 457B is exempt from that specific penalty.
That is wild.
It really is. If a city firefighter decides to retire early at age 40 and separates from service, they can begin tapping their 457B account immediately. They will pay ordinary income tax on the withdrawals, of course, but the 10% early withdrawal penalty does not exist.
Why do they get that massive perk?
It generally acknowledges that municipal jobs like police and fire often have earlier retirement ages due to the physical toll of the work. Forcing a firefighter who retires at 35 to wait until 59 and a half to access their savings without a penalty would be catastrophic.
It's an incredible benefit. Okay, let's look at another scenario. Forgetful Frank decides he hates corporate bureaucracy. He quits, cashes out, and starts a tiny consulting firm out of his garage. It's just him and three employees. He wants to set up a retirement plan, but a full 401k is way too expensive to administer. Let's compare the SEP IRA and the Simple IRA.
These are the two primary vehicles for small businesses. SEP stands for Simplified Employee Pension. The key word to lock onto for the exam is pension.
Because in a traditional pension model, the employee isn't funding it. The company is funding it.
Exactly. In a SEP IRA, only the employer makes contributions. The employee cannot defer any of their own salary into a SEP.
Oh, wow.
Right. The employer makes contributions directly into individual IRAs set up for each eligible employee. And critically, those employer contributions are immediately 100% vested. There's no cliff or graded schedule.
Okay, so how does that contrast with the SIMPLE IRA?
SIMPLE stands for Savings Incentive Match Plan for Employees. It's restricted to companies with 100 or fewer employees.
Okay.
The major differentiator is that in a SIMPLE IRA, both the employer and the employee contribute. The employee defers a portion of their salary, and the employer is legally required to make either a matching contribution or a non-elective contribution to everyone.
So if an exam question describes a small business plan where the employee is deferring 5% of their paycheck into the account, I can instantly eliminate the SEP IRA as an answer.
Instantly. If the employees are putting their own money in, it must be a SIMPLE or a 401k.
Okay, one more workplace plan. This one is for the heavy hitters. Non-qualified deferred compensation plans, often abbreviated as NQDC, or colloquially called top hat plans.
These plans are engineered exclusively for highly compensated executives.
Naturally.
Naturally. To understand why they exist, look at the math of a 401k. The IRS caps how much you can put into a 401k, around $23,000 or $24,000, depending on the year.
Which is a lot for normal people.
Sure. But if you are a CEO making $5 million a year, a $24,000 tax deduction is basically a rounding error. It doesn't help you shelter your wealth at all.
So the company creates a top hat plan. Frank, the CEO, says, hey, out of my $5 million salary, just pay me $3 million now and defer the other $2 million into this NQDC account until I retire so I don't have to pay taxes on it today.
That is exactly how it works, but there is a terrifying catch, and it's right in the name, non-qualified. These plans do not qualify for ERISA protection.
Meaning the company doesn't have to put Frank's $2 million into a legally protected separate trust fund.
Precisely. The critical phrase you must memorize for the exam is that an NQDC plan represents a mere promise to pay.
A mere promise to pay.
Yes. It is an unsecured liability of the corporation. The deferred money technically remains a general asset of the company.
Okay, let me play this out. Frank defers $2 million into the plan. 3 years later, his tech startup gets sued into oblivion and files for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. What happens to Frank's $2 million retirement nest egg?
It vanishes into the bankruptcy estate.
Wait, all of it?
All of it. Because the NQDC was not protected by an ERISA trust, Frank does not get his money. He becomes a general, unsecured creditor of the bankrupt company. He has to stand in line at the bankruptcy court, right next to the vendor who sold them office chairs, hoping the judge awards him pennies on the dollar.
That is wild. The money belongs to the company, subject to corporate creditors, until the day it is actually paid out to the executive.
It's the ultimate risk-reward trade-off. You get unlimited tax deferral, but you bear the absolute credit risk of your employer.
The wealthy live on the edge, man. All right, let's transition out of the workplace. Frank has navigated his career, he's accumulated a nest egg, and now it's time to manage it in the golden years. We need to talk about individual retirement accounts and the movement of money.
The foundational showdown here is the traditional IRA versus the Roth IRA.
The mechanics seem straightforward, but the tax implications are massive. A traditional IRA is generally funded with pre-tax dollars. I put $5,000 in. I get to deduct $5,000 from my taxable income this year. The money grows tax deferred for decades. But when I am 70 years old and I pull it out, the IRS taxes every single dollar of that withdrawal as ordinary income.
Right. You are pushing the tax burden into the future, betting that your tax bracket will be lower in retirement.
Okay.
The Roth IRA flips that equation. You fund it with after-tax dollars. You get absolutely no tax deduction today. But the money grows tax-free. And as long as you follow the aging rules, every dollar you pull out in retirement is completely tax-free.
So I take the tax hit today for a tax-free future. But the real friction between these two accounts happens at the end of the timeline, specifically with required minimum distributions or RMDs.
Yes. What's fascinating here is how the government handles their cut. They gave you a massive tax break up front with the traditional IRA, but they are not going to wait forever to collect their revenue.
Right. Under the recent Secure 2.0 Act, if you own a traditional IRA, the IRS forces you to start draining the account. You must take your first RMD by April 1st of the year, following the year you turn 73. You have to pull the money out so they can tax it. What happens with the Roth IRA? Does a 73-year-old have to drain their Roth?
No. Because the Roth IRA was funded with after-tax dollars, the IRS has already taken its cut.
Oh, so they don't care.
They don't care at all. Therefore, there are absolutely no lifetime RMDs for the original owner of a Roth IRA. You can leave that money untouched, compounding tax-free, until the day you die.
That is a staggering generational advantage. But while we are on the Roth, there is a very specific trap regarding early withdrawals. We all know the golden rule. If you touch a retirement account before age 59 and a half, you pay taxes plus a 10% penalty. But the Roth IRA has a unique layered structure, doesn't it?
It does, and it's based on first-in, first-out, or FIFO accounting rules. The money inside a Roth IRA consists of two distinct pools: your original contributions and the earnings or growth those contributions generated.
Okay.
The rule is that you can withdraw your original Roth IRA contributions at any time, at any age, for any reason, completely tax-free and penalty-free.
I want to make sure I understand this because it sounds way too good to be true. Let's say I'm 30 years old. Over the last few years, I put $10,000 of my own money into a Roth IRA. Through some lucky stock picks, the account is now worth $25,000. I want to buy a boat tomorrow. Can I just take $10,000 out of that Roth IRA without the IRS coming after me?
Yes, you can. Because that $10,000 represents your original contributions, which you already paid taxes on before depositing them. You can withdraw that principal penalty-free.
What if I try to take out $15,000 for a nicer boat?
That is where the hammer drops. You've now exhausted your $10,000 in contributions, and you are dipping into the $5,000 of earnings. Because you are under 59 and a half, that $5,000 of earnings will be subject to income tax plus the 10% early withdrawal penalty.
Oh, there it is.
The exam loves to test this nuance. Remember, contributions come out first, and they are always free and clear. Earnings have rules.
Okay, now we need to talk about how clients actually move this money around when they change jobs or switch brokerages. This brings us to the most dangerous plumbing project in finance: rollovers. The exam tests two methods: the direct transfer and the 60-day indirect rollover.
The plumbing analogy is perfect here. A direct trustee-to-trustee transfer is pure plumbing. You are connecting a sealed pipe directly from Vanguard's vault to Fidelity's vault. The money shoots through the pipe. It never touches the customer's hands.
Because I never touch the money, the IRS doesn't care, right? There's no risk I spent it on a boat.
Exactly. With a direct transfer, there is zero tax withholding, there is no reporting of a taxable event, and you can do it an unlimited number of times per year. It is foolproof.
But people don't always use the plumbing. Sometimes they use the 60-day indirect rollover. And this is not plumbing. This is a trip to the bank.
A very perilous trip. In an indirect rollover, the customer instructs their old firm to liquidate the account and send the money directly to them. The institution cuts a check made payable to the customer.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, the customer deposits the check into their personal checking account.
And the clock starts ticking immediately.
Yes. They have exactly 60 days from the date of receipt to deposit that money into a new qualified retirement account. If they miss day 60, even if they deposit it on day 61, the IRS treats the entire amount as a permanent taxable distribution.
But the time limit isn't even the most brutal part. We have to talk about the 20% withholding trap. If I have $100,000 in an old employer 401k, and I ask the plan administrator to just mail me a check for an indirect rollover, they don't send me $100,000, do they?
They do not.
Wait, really? What do they send?
By law, if an indirect rollover check is cut from a qualified employer plan, like a 401k, the IRS mandates an automatic 20% federal tax withholding.
20%?
Yep. The administrator will mail you a check for $80,000, and they will send $20,000 directly to the IRS as a prepayment of potential taxes.
But wait, the rule says I have to roll over the entire balance within 60 days to avoid a taxable event. My balance was $100,000. But I am standing in the new brokerage office holding a check for only $80,000. How do I roll over the full amount?
You have to make up the difference out of your own pocket.
Are you joking?
I am not. To complete the tax-free rollover, you must deposit $100,000 into the new IRA. You deposit the $80,000 check, and then you have to drain your personal savings to come up with the missing $20,000.
That is infuriating. I have to loan the IRS 20 grand just to move my own money.
Yes. If you successfully deposit the full $100,000 out of pocket within 60 days, the IRS will refund you the $20,000 withholding when you file your taxes the following spring.
And what if I don't have $20,000 just sitting in my checking account? What if I just deposit the $80,000 check and say, good enough?
Then the $80,000 is successfully rolled over, but that missing $20,000 is permanently considered a taxable distribution. You will owe ordinary income tax on it, plus the 10% penalty if you are under 59 and a half.
Yeah.
All because you didn't use a direct trustee-to-trustee transfer.
Always use the plumbing. Never take the check. Now, there is another rule that causes immense confusion here, the once-per-year rule.
Yes. The once per year rule states that an individual can only complete one rollover per 12-month period. But you have to be very precise about where this applies.
Right. It only applies to 60-day IRA to IRA indirect rollovers. Mm-hmm. If I take a check from my IRA, hold it for 30 days, and put it in a new IRA, I can't do that again for 365 days.
Correct. But the exam will try to trick you by applying that rule to other movements.
Like what?
Does the once per year rule apply to direct trustee to trustee transfers? No. Those are unlimited. Does it apply to rolling an old 401k into an IRA? No. Employer to IRA rollovers are exempt from the once per year limitation. It strictly governs IRA to IRA indirect trips to the bank.
Got it. And one final rule on moving money. What if I am 75 years old, I take my required minimum distribution for the year, and I decide I don't need the money? Can I just roll that RMD into a different IRA?
Absolutely not. Required minimum distributions can never be rolled over. The government wants its tax revenue. If it's an RMD, you must take it, keep it in a taxable account, and pay the taxes.
All right, we have navigated the workplace, we've navigated retirement, we have arrived at the final stage of the life cycle: death, taxes, and inheritance. Let's introduce our final archetype.
Deceased Dave. Rest in peace, Dave.
R.I.P. Dave. Let's look at what Dave leaves behind. Let's say Dave was a patient investor. 40 years ago, he opened a standard taxable brokerage account and bought $10,000 worth of blue chip stocks. Okay, $10,000.
On the day Dave passes away, the market has boomed, and that account is now worth $100,000. He leaves this taxable account to his nephew, Reckless Randy.
Now, if Dave had sold those stocks the day before he died, he would have realized a massive $90,000 capital gain, and the IRS would take a huge chunk in capital gains taxes.
Right.
But because Dave died holding them, Randy gets to use the ultimate tax loophole, the magic eraser.
The magic eraser is technically called the step up in basis. When Randy inherits those taxable securities, the IRS completely erases Dave's original $10,000 cost basis. The IRS steps the basis up to the fair market value on the exact date of Dave's death.
So Randy's official purchase price in the eyes of the IRS is $100,000. That $90,000 of growth that happened over 40 years, it vanishes. It is never taxed.
Never.
If Randy logs into the account the day after the funeral and liquidates the entire portfolio for $100,000, he owes absolutely zero capital gains tax.
It is arguably the most powerful wealth transfer mechanism in the tax code. It exists primarily to prevent double taxation, ensuring assets aren't hit with both estate taxes and capital gains taxes simultaneously.
Oh, that makes sense.
There's also an alternate valuation date option, where the estate executor can choose to set the basis at the fair market value exactly 6 months after the date of death, which is usually utilized if the stock market crashes right after the person dies to lower the overall estate value.
That sounds like a great deal for Randy. But there is a massive catch that the exam will test aggressively. The step up in basis applies to taxable accounts. What happens if Dave leaves a retirement account to Randy, say a massive traditional IRA?
The hammer drops. Inherited retirement accounts, whether it's a traditional IRA, a 401k, or 403b, do not get a step up in basis.
This is where people fail. The test will describe an inherited traditional IRA and ask what the cost basis is, trying to lure you into picking the date of death value. But you can't use the magic eraser here. Why?
Because the mechanics of the account are entirely different. The money inside Dave's traditional IRA was deposited pre-tax. Dave never paid a dime of income tax on it. The IRS has been waiting patiently for decades to get their cut of that income. Mm. You're not going to let Randy inherit it and walk away tax-free. Every single dollar Randy pulls out of that inherited traditional IRA will be taxed to Randy as ordinary income in the year he withdraws it.
Okay, so a traditional IRA is a tax bomb for the heir. But what if Dave was incredibly forward-thinking and he built up a massive Roth IRA? He leaves the Roth to Randy. Now, we established earlier that original Roth owners, like Dave, never have to take lifetime RMDs. He can let it grow forever.
Right.
So, audience question time. If Randy inherits it, can Randy just leave the money in the Roth for the next 50 years, letting it compound tax-free until he retires? Pause and think.
This one catches a lot of people off guard.
So what's the answer? Can he?
He cannot. This is a massive change in the law brought about by the original Secure Act in 2019, which effectively killed what was known as the stretch IRA. Congress realized that allowing inherited Roths to grow tax-free across multiple generations was costing the government way too much future revenue.
So what is the new rule?
It is called the 10-year rule. Most non-spouse beneficiaries, like a nephew, an adult child, or a friend, must completely empty an inherited IRA by the end of the 10th year following the year of the original owner's death.
Even a Roth IRA.
Yes, even a Roth IRA. Now, the distributions from the inherited Roth will still be tax-free to Randy when he pulls them out, assuming Dave met the 5-year aging requirement. But Randy cannot leave the money sheltered in the account. The IRS says, you have 1 decade to drain this vehicle.
Are there any exceptions to that 10-year countdown?
There are a few, categorized as eligible designated beneficiaries. The primary exception is the surviving spouse. A spouse doesn't have to follow the 10-year rule. They can choose a spousal rollover, where they simply move the inherited IRA into their own name and treat it as if they had owned it all along.
Wow, that's huge.
It is. Minor children of the deceased are also exempt, but only temporarily. Once the minor child turns 21, the 10-year clock starts ticking. But for a healthy adult non-spouse like Randy, the 10-year rule is absolute.
It forces the money out into the open economy. All right, we have covered an incredible amount of ground. We've taken a dollar from the new account forms through the corporate matching schedules into the rollover pipes and finally to the probate courts. It is time to lock these concepts in with a rapid-fire recap. I'm going to throw out the scenario. You hit me with the testable takeaway. Ready?
Ready, let's do it.
A Series 6 rep wants to change a customer's account name after a divorce. Who approves it?
A registered principal must be informed of the essential facts and approve the change in writing. The representative cannot authorize it.
Reckless Randy gets eaten by a shark. He had a JTWROS account and a TIC account. Where does the money flow?
The JTWROS account passes immediately to the surviving joint owner, totally avoiding the probate courts. The TIC account's a fractional share goes straight into Randy's estate and must endure probate.
Forgetful Frank's startup matches his 401k contributions. When is Frank's own deferred salary fully vested?
Employee deferrals are always 100% vested immediately. Only the employer match is subject to vesting schedules, like a 3-year cliff.
A 42-year-old city planner quits and wants to cash out their governmental 457b plan. Do they pay the 10% early withdrawal penalty?
0% penalty. Governmental 457b plans are not subject to ERISA, and they have no 10% penalty upon separation from service, regardless of age.
A client takes a 60-day indirect rollover check directly from their 401k to deposit into an IRA. What is the immediate danger?
The mandatory 20% federal tax withholding. The client only receives an 80% check, but they must deposit 100% of the original balance into the new IRA within 60 days to avoid a massive taxable event. They have to make up that 20% out of pocket.
Deceased Dave leaves his niece a taxable stock portfolio and a traditional IRA. What happens to the cost basis?
The taxable stocks receive a magical stepped-up basis to the fair market value at the date of death, erasing all previous capital gains. But the inherited traditional IRA gets absolutely no step-up, and every withdrawal is taxed to the niece as ordinary income.
Flawless. So what does this all mean? We've thrown a lot of tax codes, regulations, and fictional characters at you today.
We have. And if we connect all of this to the bigger picture, we spent this entire deep dive talking about these strict compliance frameworks that FINRA and the IRS use to track human behavior. We've talked about ink on paper and percentages.
But there is a collision coming, isn't there?
Exactly. Here is something for you to mull over as you prep for this exam. We've talked about how essential a Series 6 representative is in catching a 60-day rollover error, or ensuring a trusted contact person isn't acting as an unauthorized power of attorney. But as the wealth management industry rapidly moves toward AI and algorithmic automation, who is going to be held liable when the machine makes a mistake?
Oh, that's a good question.
If an automated robo-advisor initiates an indirect rollover and fails to warn the client about the 20% withholding trap, costing them a fifth of their life savings in taxes, who answers to the regulators?
Right.
The software developer.
Right.
The compliance officer. Or you, the registered representative, whose name is still on the master account file. The rules of wealth transfer were written for a paper world, and they are about to violently collide with the age of automation. You aren't just learning these rules to pass a test. You are learning them because soon you might be the only human being in the loop who actually understands them.
That is a terrifying and incredibly important thought. The stakes are real, and understanding the why behind these rules is your best defense. You've got this exam in the bag. Keep your rules in their respective corners. Always use the plumbing and watch out for the sharks. Thanks for diving deep with us today. We will catch you on the next deep dive.